Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. What do you think of that? Any good? I'm trialing that one. I can do better. We can do better. Anyway, today we're up to chapter 4. We're going to read chapter 4 of The Open Boat by Stephen Crane, but first we are going to discuss chapter 3. The questions that I threw out to the community around chapter 3 were these. Firstly, this seemed like a rather optimistic and hopeful chapter. What did you make of this? Secondly, Crane seems to be using lots of hints and hidden messages. Did you detect anything that you suspect has a deeper meaning behind it? And number 3, I found this chapter to be quite comical in some parts. Did any lines make you laugh or smile? Yes, so for me, this chapter 3, was a big shift in tone in the story. Things became very hopeful and almost like cheery, right? But it also had that kind of undertone of like danger. Like, you know, when you become a bit cocky and you risk making silly mistakes because you get overconfident. So it was kind of that interesting feeling of like, they're feeling really good, but at the same time it makes the reader feel a bit uneasy. B.C. Shu said, I really like the final line. The final line was, everybody took a drink of water. I feel like as a reader, I hadn't even considered the water situation, though it would probably be the top priority for everyone on board. The author does a great job of not even mentioning it until the very end, as if it's an element so important that the passengers aren't even going to waste a drop, but the sight of land gives them the okay to drink. As a classics major, I worry about our characters' chances of actually making it onto land without a major mishap. Odysseus and his crew could see the fires on the shore of Ithaca, and were blown back due to the greed and curiosity of the men. Surely the ending can't be as simple as it might seem right now. Terrifics that I thought about the Odyssey as well. Funny how the mind works. It also is perhaps worth mentioning that it's precisely in a time of hope returning that we relax out of our fight mode and that we can and that we can succumb to accidents because of loss of focus, and that our bodies begin to feel the pain that's been suppressed. Many deaths of survivors occur at the moment of rescue precisely because we allow ourselves to relax. So for me, the hopefulness of this chapter is twined with a sense of heightened danger. Gee, terrific, mod extraordinaire of the subreddit. Terrific, that is pretty grim. Many deaths of survivors occur at the moment of rescue precisely because we allow ourselves to relax at that moment. Wow. That's nasty. Mellow Yellow said, surely the ending can't be as simple as it might seem right now, right? We're only on chapter 3. Plenty of time still for the bottom to drop out in the next 4. The calm before the storm. Yeah, the calm before the storm, right? Feels a bit that way. Vlad the Mystic said, very hopeful chapter indeed. The promise of land is actually met. It is actually real, sorry. And the sound of the surf and the increasing size of the land from a slither of paper to something substantial made me feel really hopeful. However, there are still hidden dangers alluded to in the writing. No other boats have made it to the lighthouse. There seems to be no rescue crew. Reaching the lighthouse might only be a waypoint towards eventual rescue. Interesting point. I'm just sort of thinking that the lighthouse or land itself is salvation. You know, they're saved at that point, but that could just be the beginning of the journey. Some intriguing hints that Vlad the Mystic found. It is mentioned that no one got any sleep for 2 nights prior to the sinking of the ship. Why was this? Was the ship doomed to sink? Were they fighting a storm that came out of the blue? And what happened to the other boats and survivors? Also, how was the captain injured and no one else was? All interesting questions. Fighting a storm for 2 days, is that possible? Is there storms that last for multiple days out at sea? I actually am asking because I genuinely have no idea. But that is a pretty harrowing thought. Being on a ship, fighting a storm for 48 hours. The promise of land made the burden of rowing seem light to everyone. So even the drudgery of rowing could be looked at in a comical way and not a tragic Sisyphean effort. The image of the four survivors smoking a cigar on a tinny dinghy certainly brought a smile to my face. Yeah, that last image of them finding the cigars was almost like the whole chapter was things are starting to go their way. And that was almost like to a comedic level. Someone suddenly finds cigars. Like, previous to that, Crane had sort of set this imagery, in my head at least, that it was just the four men in a tiny little boat with nothing but sort of the clothes on their backs. But then suddenly they've got water and they've got cigars of all things and matches to light the cigars. Sleeping Buddha said, I like how this chapter ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. Despite the optimistic, they have still not reached land. Also, who knows what dangers await them if/when they do reach land. Due to the restraint by Crane in revealing the setting, we know so little about where they are that they might actually be in unfriendly territory, and that the worst part of their journey might still be ahead of them. Yeah, it is quite well done, isn't it? I'm not sure if we're meant to have context already, like someone going into this story back in the day when it was written would already know about the shipwreck that Crane's talking about, or if he's done that intentionally to sort of slowly unravel the story. Levy619 said, Crane is being very deliberate with how he reveals the setting and the scenario. Every fact about the setting has been intentional, and Crane has not told us much about how or why they got into the dinghy. Notably, the captain telling the cook and correspondent to conserve their strength and the drink of water both remind us that they have limited resources and limited time. The cigars could be seen as a triumph over nature, as a man-made pleasure. While they smoked them in gaiety, I expect that the sea giveth and the sea taketh away. Cigars would make them thirstier and could worsen their problems. Asep Hull said, I was quite impressed they lit four cigars off three matches while in a small boat exposed to the elements at sea. Achievement unlocked. Yeah, actually, three matches to light four cigars in a bobbing boat in the wind is... that's cutting it fine. Levy619 said if they lit one, they could light the others with that one. I feel that they are smaller cigarillo-type cigars and not big torpedoes. Having eight big cigars in a pocket would not be easy or comfortable. Could be the case, who knows. I had the picture of them having those big sausage-looking cigars, you know, those ones that you smoke when you're celebrating. Waraka Agpar said, it was a more hopeful chapter, though the cook's belief that the life-saving station at the lighthouse is closed seems to portend more trouble. Also, I cannot imagine having to swim ashore on little sleep after days of rowing. After the captain's warning, Crane noted the wind died slowly. The cook and the correspondent were now obliged to slave in order to hold high the oar. What keeps the ship adrift? It seemed to me there was a parallel between the crew's good spirits and their fortune. They are successful only as long as they are hopeful. Waraka Akbar also said, surely somewhere in the world a rowing crew has emblazoned on the wall of their practice center Crane's ode to their beloved sport. The correspondent wondered ingenuously how, in the name of all that was sane, could there be people who thought it amusing to row a boat. It was not an amusement, it was a diabolical punishment, and even a genius of mental aberrations could never conclude that it was anything but a horror to the muscles and a crime against the back. Islands on the coast, said I, absolutely loved the rowing description, it's so spot on, it is a damn tough sport. That was actually, for me, that was one of the funnier lines in the chapter. A crime against the back is a pretty comical way to describe it. Our VIP said, I enjoyed the description of the comradeship, the iron-bound friendship. Even the cynical correspondent seems to love these guys like brothers. That was actually, at the very start of the chapter, that was pretty kind of heartwarming. A little bit touching. I really enjoyed reading that part. That friendship that this whole thing had brought them even closer together. That was nice. But for me, it was very foreboding because it was so nice. It was such a nice moment. Kind of hopeful as well that, it's like this whole chapter, right? This whole chapter was the same for me. It was all nice and happy and hopeful and optimistic, but it just makes you uneasy that something's going to go wrong. Islands on the coast said, I wonder if R.R. Martin drew inspiration from this with the Ironborn Greyjoys. Probably not. Either way, this was maybe my favourite chapter so far, due to the unspoken brotherhood dynamic. Yeah, I think that description of their friendship was maybe my favourite part of the story so far. Swim said, the Mama Fishy said, their favourite line, there was this comradeship that the correspondent, for instance, who had been taught to be cynical of men, knew, even at the time, was the best experience of his life. A very optimistic statement. Isn't it funny that during probably one of the worst experiences of his life, the whole shipwreck and people dying and drowning and all the rest, embedded in that is the best experience of his life being the comradeship that he's feeling for these other men. Right Way Up said, it kind of sounds too good to be true. They are still about an hour away from shore and the lighting of the cigars seems like a classic early celebration. Oof, yeah. They're celebrating too early. You're right. I liked the mental picture of them coming into shore, landing at the beach, having these big cigars hanging out of their mouths and celebrating. But I don't know if we'll actually see that reality come to be. Right Way Up also said, the oiler or the correspondent took the oars again. Has there been any other examples of a vague storyteller? Yeah, the word or there. The oiler or the correspondent took the oars again. That is a funny bit there. That detail is foggy for the narrator. Guarinardle said, I thought it was interesting that the cook was the one that pointed out the House of Refuge when he was the one in Chapter 1 arguing that the House of Refuge may actually be a life-saving station. I think his optimism has rubbed off on the others since the captain was the one who brought up the life-saving people in this chapter. Woozum said, yeah. First the cook says that the life-saving station was abandoned, then moments later calls it a House of Refuge and expects a rescue. I wonder if it's him swinging between hope and futility, or what. White War War singled out the following line, previously to the foundering. By the way, the oiler had worked double watch in the engine room of the ship. I absolutely loved this line. The prose has been so dramatic and filled with tension, and in this chapter, along with the calmer, more comical moments, though again I loved the little pun in chapter 2, adding a by the way to a written text takes the narrator from an omnipotent being to a storyteller, taking a second to speak directly to us while telling his story. Previously to the foundering, by the way, the oiler had worked double watch in the engine room of the ship. Yeah, sorry, I just had to sort of try that out again, but yeah, it does kind of, makes the narrator, I think he's starting to maybe reveal that the narrator is the correspondent, could it be? Maybe? Crane, has wonderful descriptive prose, but he also seems to like to give the audience a little wink every once in a while. I'm digging it very much. Glad there's a second story from the guy on the list. Yeah, me too, Why to a War. And before I read The Open Boat, I read blurbs for The Open Boat and The Blue Hotel. And The Blue Hotel was actually the one I was more excited for. And I'm really loving The Open Boat, so I'm actually, I'm really looking forward to the next story, which will start only in a few days. We're up to chapter 4, so in 4 days from now, we'll be starting The Blue Hotel. Planning for a burial said, "The hopefulness of this chapter makes me anxious for what's going to happen to the characters. Relaxing enough to smoke cigars, use some of their last matches, and start drinking what I assume is the last of their water makes me feel like something is going to happen." Islands on the Coast, very fitting username for this story, said, "I mentioned this elsewhere, but I really enjoyed the unspoken bond Crane discussed the guys feel towards each other in this dire situation. I think it nails what it would actually feel like to be in this scenario, where you each heavily rely on one another." I agree with Crane's description of rowing. I've never been good at it, and it is a much more massive workout than it appears. And finally, in response to the question about which line in this book put a smile on their face, Islands on the Coast said, "What a rejuvenating and delightful final line." The one about them having a drink of water. Lipstick Singularity said, "Today was my first day reading. My free online copy didn't have chapter markers. I guess I was overly enthusiastic because I ended up finishing The Open Boat by accident. I won't post any spoilers, but I will say I enjoyed it. I'll get the hang of this. See you in 4 days when I'm back in sync. I'm excited for this subreddit." Thanks, Lipstick Singularity. Welcome to the project. You got a bit excited there and read the whole story, but that's okay, that can happen. That used to happen all the time with War and Peace. When it got to an exciting chapter with a cliffhanger, everyone would read ahead one extra chapter or two extra chapters to find out what happens. So, yeah, it's understandable. Wasm said, "The captain recalls 7 faces looking at him on the boat. There are 4 dry and 4 wet cigars. Wondering if it tells the fate of the rest of the crew or the characters' futures, especially with the literal calm before the storm with the wind dying down." Oh, that could be it. Yeah, so the captain recalls 7 faces looking at him. And we assumed earlier that he was recalling 7 people who had died. But maybe it's to say that that little rowing boat had 7 people on it to begin with. And now only 4 of them remain. Well, you know, him plus 3. Which would mean that originally there was 8 people. Maybe there was 8 crew on his ship. Maybe that was what it was. And only 4 of them made it to the dinghy. And now only 4 remain. So that would be why there was 8 cigars. That could be it. That could be it. I thought that the detail about there being 4 dry and 4 wet cigars was just to emphasize the feeling of things are going their way, right? Because by this point, it's getting a little bit even comical how much things are starting to look in their favor. And when one of them happens to find cigars, but oh no, some of them are wet, but all they need is 4 dry ones, and it happens that there are 4 dry ones. It's like comically, perfectly going their way, right? And the same with the fact that they happen to have 3 dry matches at the same time. But, no, it could be. I mean, we were talking about the hints and the secret meanings in the text. And I think by now it's obvious that Crane is embedding little hints and secrets into the text. And a lot of the small details, like the numbers of things, are very much intentional. Mr. Philip Pirrip said, "Great point. There may be a connection between those numbers, though one I'm not seeing. The captain plus seven faces in the water equals eight total men, so an eight total cigars. But where did the dry and wet ones come in? Four men total in the boat, four wet cigars, four dry. They were surprised that any were salvageable, perhaps paralleling their own doubts at success in the earlier chapters. The cigars could represent 50-50 chance they'll make it, totally up to the chance and out of their hands. Our four men are alive," said Righty McRightface. "If a little worse for wear, while the four other men from the ship are probably dead at the bottom of the sea. The men in the boat may be wet, but their comrades who didn't make it are quite, literally, soaked to the bone. Four dry cigars, four soaked cigars." Ooh, I like this imagery. I like this kind of hidden meanings in things. That's really cool. Laura Y. Stitch said, "There's optimism from the beginning, talking about friendship, to the end, the drinking of the water. And of course the middle, with the resting, thanks to the sail, the sighting of land, and the finding of the cigars. What I found most comical was the correspondent thinking about how people row for enjoyment. Particularly, it was not an amusement, it was a diabolical punishment. The use of diabolical punishment contrasts with the optimistic feel in the rest of the prose." Another good detail there that had slipped my mind was, yeah, how they used a sail, which again was just something that didn't seem like it would work, right? It seemed like a silly idea to put up put up the captain's jacket as a sail. But it does work, and it's just another example of in this chapter how things are going their way to an almost comical degree. Alviric said, "I'm so nervous for everyone. The chapter made it seem like they were bound to make it to land eventually, but I can't help but assume the story's about to take a turn for the worst. Maybe I'm pessimistic." I think it's natural, Alviric, to be pessimistic at this point because their optimism is becoming a bit unchecked. So our natural response is to sort of curb it with a bit of pessimism. I'm worried that as they get towards the shore, sometimes it's the, what do they call them, the breakers, right? The waves that break on the shore. And if it's got a lot of rocks and that kind of thing, that can be quite deadly, trying to get from the ocean to the beach. So, yeah, I'm a bit worried for that part of the story. It would be sort of bitterly ironic if they make it to shore, but crash and die, or, you know, on just landing on the shore. And bitter irony is something you often see in literature, so yeah, I'm worried. That's what I'm worried about personally. Anyway, I don't want to make too many predictions about what's going to happen, because if I'm right, it's kind of like a spoiler, even though it's just a guess. But you know what I mean. Alright, so let's move to the next chapter, shall we? Stephen Crane's The Open Boat, Chapter 4. "Cook," remarked the captain, "there don't seem to be any signs of life about your house of refuge." "No," replied the cook. "Funny, they don't see us." A broad stretch of lowly coast lay before the eyes of the men. It was the dunes, topped with dark vegetation. The roar of the surf was plain, and sometimes they could see the white lip of a wave as it spun up the beach. A tiny house was blocked out, black upon the sky. Southward, the slim lighthouse lifted its little grey length. Tide, wind, and waves were swinging the dinghy northward. "Funny, they don't see us," said the men. The surf's roar was here dulled, but its tone was, nevertheless, thunderous and mighty. As the boat swam over the great rollers, the men sat listening to this roar. will swamp shore, said everybody. It is fair to say here that there was not a life-saving station within 20 miles in either direction, but the men did not know this fact, and in consequence they made dark and opprobrious remarks concerning the eyesight of the nation's life-savers. 4 scowling men sat in the dinghy and surpassed records in the invention of epithets. Funny they don't see us. The light-heartedness of a former time had completely faded. To their sharpened minds it was easy to conjure pictures of all kinds of incompetency and blindness and indeed cowardice. There was the shore of the populous land, and it was bitter and bitter to them that from it came no sign. Well, said the captain ultimately, I suppose we'll have to make a try for ourselves. If we stay out here too long, none of us have the strength left to swim after the boat swamps. And so the oiler, who was at the oars, turned the boat straight for the shore. There was a sudden tightening of muscle. There was some thinking. If we don't all get ashore, said the captain, if we don't all get ashore, I suppose you fellows know where to send news of my finish. They then briefly exchanged some addresses and admonitions. As for the reflections of the men, there was a great deal of rage in them. Perchance they might be formulated thus. If I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, why, in the name of the 7 mad gods who ruled the sea, why was I allowed to come thus far and contemplate sand and trees? Why was I brought here, merely to have my nose dragged away as I was about to nibble the sacred cheese of life? It is preposterous. If this old ninny woman, fate, cannot do better than this, she should be deprived of the management of men's fortunes. She is an old hen who knows not her intention. If she has decided to drown me, why did she not do it in the beginning and save me all this trouble? The whole affair is absurd, but no, she cannot mean to drown me. She dare not drown me. She cannot drown me, not after all this work. Afterward, the man might have made an impulse to shake his fist at the clouds. Just you drown me now, and then hear what I call you. The billows that came at this time were more formidable. They seemed always just about to break and roll over the little boat in a turmoil of foam. There was a preparatory and long growl in the speech of them. No mind unused to the sea would have concluded that the dinghy could ascend these sheer heights in time. The shore was still afar. The oiler was a wily surfman. Boys, he said swiftly, she won't live 3 minutes more, and we're too far out to swim. Shall I take her to sea again, Captain? Yes, go ahead, said the captain. This oiler, by a series of quick miracles and fast and steady oarsmanship, turned the boat in the middle of the surf and took her safely to sea again. There was a considerable silence as the boat bumped over the furrowed sea to deep water. Then somebody in gloom spoke. Well, anyhow, they must have seen us from the shore by now. The gulls went in slanting flight up the wind toward the grey desolate east. A squall, marked by dingy clouds, and clouds brick red like smoke from a burning building, appeared in the southeast. What do you think of those life-saving people? Ain't they peaches? Funny they haven't seen us. Maybe they think we're out here for sport. Maybe they think we're fishing. Maybe they think we're damn fools. It was a long afternoon. A changed tide tried to force them southward, but the wind and waves said northward. Far ahead, where coastline, sea, and sky formed their mighty angle, there were little dots which seemed to indicate a city on the shore. St. Augustine? The captain shook his head. Too near Mosquito Inlet. And the Oiler Road, and then the Correspondent Road. Then the Oiler Road. It was a weary business. The human back can become the seat of more aches and pains than are registered in books for the composite anatomy of a regiment. It is a limited area, but it can become the theatre of innumerable muscular conflicts, tangles, wrenches, knots, and other comforts. Did you ever like to row, Billy? Asked the correspondent. No, said the oiler. Hang it. When one exchanged the rowing seat for a place in the bottom of the boat, he suffered a bodily depression that caused him to be careless of everything save an obligation to wiggle one finger. There was cold seawater swashing to and fro in the boat, and he lay in it. His head, pillowed on a thwart, was within an inch of the swirl of a wave crest, and sometimes a particularly obstreperous sea came inboard and drenched him once more. But these matters did not annoy him. It is almost certain that if the boat had capsized, he would have tumbled comfortably out upon the ocean as if he felt sure that it was a great soft mattress. Look, there's a man on the shore. Where? There, see him? See him? Yes, sure, he's walking along. Now he's stopped. Look, he's facing us. He's waving at us. So he is, by thunder. Ah, now we're all right. Now we're all right. There'll be a boat out here for us in half an hour. He's going on, he's running. He's going up to that house there. The remote beach seemed lower than the sea, and it required a searching glance to discern the little black figure. The captain saw a floating stick, and they rowed to it. A bath towel was by some weird chance in the boat, and tying this on the stick, the captain waved it. The oarsman did not dare turn his head, so he was obliged to ask questions. What's he doing now? He's standing still again. He's looking, I think. There he goes again, towards the house. Now he's stopped again. Is he waving at us? No, not now. He was, though. Look, there comes another man. He's running. Look at him go, would you? Why, he's on a bicycle. Now he's met the other man. They're both waving at us. Look. There comes something up the beach. What the devil is that thing? Why, it looks like a boat. Why, certainly it's a boat. No, it's on wheels. Yes, so it is. Well, that must be the lifeboat. They drag them along shore on a wagon. That's the lifeboat, sure. No, by... It's an omnibus. I tell you, it's a lifeboat. It is not, it's an omnibus. I can see it plain. See? One of these big hotel omnibuses. By thunder, you're right. It's an omnibus. Sure as fate. What do you suppose they are doing with an omnibus? Maybe they are going around collecting the life crew, eh? That's it, likely. Look, there's a fellow waving a little black flag. He's standing on the steps of the omnibus. There come those other two fellows. Now they're all talking together. Look, that fellow with the flag, maybe he ain't waving it. That ain't a flag, is it? That's his coat. Why, certainly that's his coat. Ah, so it is. It is his coat. He's taken it off and he's waving it around his head. But would you look at him swing it? Oh, say, there isn't any life-saving station there. That's just a winter resort hotel omnibus that has brought over some of the boarders to see us drown. What's that idiot with the coat mean? What's he signalling, anyhow? It looks as if he were trying to tell us to go north. There must be a life-saving station up there. No, he thinks we're fishing. Just giving us a merry hand, see? Ah, there, Willie. Well, I wish I could make something out of those signals. What do you suppose he means?
He don't mean anything, he's just playing.
Well, if he'd just signal us to try the surf again, or to go to sea and wait, or go north, or go south, or go to hell, there would be some reason in it. But look at him. He just stands there and keeps his coat revolving, like a wheel. The arse.
There come more people.
Oh, now there's quite a mob. Look, isn't that a boat?
Where? Oh, I see what you mean. No, that's no boat.
That fellow is still waving his coat.
He must think we like to see him do that. Why don't he quit it?
It don't mean anything.
I don't know. I think he is trying to make us go north. It must be that there's a life-saving station there somewhere.
Say, he ain't tired yet. Look at him wave.
Wonder how long he can keep that up. He's been revolving his coat ever since he caught sight of us.
He's an idiot.
Why aren't they getting men to bring a boat out? A fishing boat? One of those big yawls?
Could come out here, all right.
Why don't he do something?
Oh, it's all right now. They'll have a boat out here for us in less than no time, now that they've seen us.
A faint yellow tone came into the sky over the low land. The shadows of the sea slowly deepened. The wind bore coldness with it, and the men began to shiver.
"Holy smoke," said one, allowing his voice to express his impious mood.
"If we keep on monkeying out here, if we've got to flounder out here all night..."
"Oh, we'll never have to stay here all night, don't you worry. They've seen us now, and it won't be long before they'll come chasing out after us."
The shore grew dusky. The man waving a coat blended gradually into this gloom, and it swallowed, in the same manner, the omnibus and the group of people. The spray, when it dashed uproariously over the side, made the voyagers shrink and swear like men who were being branded.
"I'd like to catch that chump who waved the coat. I feel like soaking him one, just for luck."
"Why, what did he do?"
"Oh, nothing, but then he seemed so damn cheerful."
In the meantime, the oiler rowed, and then the correspondent rowed, and then the oiler rowed. Grey-faced and bowed forward, they mechanically, turn by turn, plied the leaden oars. The form of the lighthouse had vanished from the southern horizon, but finally a pale star appeared, just lifting from the sea. The streaked saffron in the west passed before the all-merging darkness, and the sea to the east was black. The land had vanished and was expressed only by the low and drear thunder of the surf.
"If I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, why, in the name of the seven mad gods who rule the sea, was I allowed to come thus far and contemplate sand and trees? Was I brought here merely to have my nose dragged away, as I was able to nibble the sacred cheese of life?"
The patient captain, drooped over the water jar, was sometimes obliged to speak to the oarsman.
"Keep her head up, keep her head up.
Keep her head up, sir." The voices were weary and low. This was surely a quiet evening. All save the oarsman lay heavily and listlessly in the boat's bottom. As for him, his eyes were just capable of noting the tall black waves that swept forward in a most sinister silence, save for an occasional subdued growl of a crest. The cook's head was on a thwart, and he looked without interest at the water under his nose. He was deep in other scenes. Finally he spoke.
"Billy," he murmured dreamfully, "what kind of pie do you like best?"
"All right, there we go, another chapter down."
Whew. That was a frustrating one, and really fun to read, though. Frustrating for the characters, but I don't know. Like, every chapter I read of this, it's just
more and more well written. Like, that was fantastic. All right, I will leave a few discussion prompts on the subreddit for this chapter. Jump over there and have your say. Let's discuss it, the chapter, and tomorrow we'll come back and cover the conversation half. Before I sign off for the day, I'll remind you of how you can support this podcast. We have a Patreon page, patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. You can donate as little as $1 a month for as many or as few months as you like. Just go ahead there and contribute what you feel matches the value of the podcast. Another way to support this podcast is by buying the official paperbacks that I've published. The Hemingway list paperbacks. We're going to be making the box set of every one of these 16 stories over the course of this podcast. The first two are already available. Stephen Crane's The Open Boat and The Blue Hotel are in the first book, and the second book is James Joyce's Dubliners. Go to thehemingwaylist.com and look for the link that says Our Official Paperbacks. You can find it on the right-hand side toolbar, or if you're on a mobile device, the mobile website, you scroll right down to the bottom and you'll find the link. You can also search for the Hemingway list on Amazon and you should be able to find the books there. All right, very cool. Thank you very much for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.